Yeah, I feel the California sun beating down. Yeah, I see the pretty roses sprout from the ground. You hear voices whisper through the mission walls, louder than all the kids and the parents' cell phone calls.
Good evening and welcome to American Indian Airwaves Coyote Radio. For Marcus Lopez, Larry Smith, and Fabiana Hirsch, I'm one of your hosts, Corey Dubin. This week, we will revisit the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. In a conversation with Tupac Enrique of Tona Tierra, we explore the ongoing struggles to strengthen and implement the Declaration while confronting the many challenges and roadblocks being thrown up. In our second and final segment, we focus on agricultural sustainability and a project here in Los Angeles with First Nations peoples. We will hear from the Tiot Society's Cindy Alvitri and Olivia Chumacero about Farm Lab. And as always, news and views from Abiaiala North, Turtle Island, and Abiaiala South, the land of the condor. You are in tune with Coyote Radio, American Indian Airwaves.
You can hear when the moon shines bright, the lone fool in the black of the night. You can hear the whisper in the valley. Mm-hmm. And you know when Kamakani blows to the bahu drum, it's the warriors who are marching. Mm-hmm. Down the mountain. Mm-hmm. Because history ain't no mystery to me. Been marching through the pain and the loss that I see. And a revolution is boiling up in me.
I'm Corey Dubin.
And I'm Marcus Lopez.
And you're in tune with Coyote Radio, American Indian Airwaves. And we turn our attention to the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, Marcus, and the UN Permanent Forum. And with that, struggles regarding the North American Caucus and an upcoming meeting or conference, there seems to be some question. As always, we're pleased to be joined by Tupac Enrique from Tona Tierra in Phoenix, Arizona. Welcome back to the program, Tupac.
Hey, good afternoon, Corey. Hey, Marcus.
Tupac, you went through the North American Indigenous Peoples Caucus, and that was in British Columbia, Canada. And you talked about many things in the World Conference, one of the issues being the World Conference of Indigenous Peoples, amongst other things. Why don't you talk to us about, and the listeners, about the caucus and what terminated?
This event that's being projected to take place, or has been projected up to this point to take place at the UN in New York, the General Assembly, a high-level plenary meeting of all the government states of the UN system in September. It's not a conference. It's not a United Nations conference. It's a formal meeting at the high level, a plenary meeting, meaning of all the member states of the UN system, but it is not. It never was a conference in the sense of a United Nations conference. A United Nations conference would imply, such as the conference on racism, the conference on climate, a whole level and series of events, preparatory events, position papers, regional meetings, consultations, experts, discussions at a level that would eventually produce a session in terms of conference at the United Nations of from 7 to maybe 10 days. And here, this high-level plenary is situated to take place in September and will only last a day and a half. And in the middle of that day-and-a-half session, there's going to be an interruption, and that interruption is going to occur when the President of the United States, Mr. Barack Obama, takes the floor of the General Assembly and will basically truncate and contextualize whatever deliberations come out of this event. So clarifying, number one, this high-level plenary that's set for September 2014 at the UN never was a conference. It is not a conference. And number two, at the North American Regional Indigenous Peoples Caucus, which just took place in Kamloops territory of the Sequoia nation, which is unceded territory known as British Columbia within the context of Canada, but it never was ceded to either British Columbia or Canada or Great Britain. It still is Indigenous nation territory. We were there in their homelands, greeted by them and received by them. And at this regional gathering of the Native American Caucus of North America, one of the regions that participates in the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, which is coming up in May, the call was made very definitely to cancel this high-level plenary, first of all, and stop calling it a conference when it ever was. So this demand by the Native American Caucus of North America has since circulated to the other caucus. The Arctic Caucus has since taken a similar position, and there's many other statements that are coming in from around the world related to this theme. So it's a turbulent period right now in the international agenda, because apparently the president of the UN General Assembly, Mr. John Ash, who's from the country, the state of Antigua Barbuda in the Caribbean, is pushing forward with this mechanism of subverting the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, basically subverting it and undermining it by going forward with this process where the government states of the world of the UN system will be sitting down without Indigenous peoples' participation and discussing the implementation of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And this is being done in a series and set of events to where the Indigenous people's voice and participation, full and effective participation, which was the call made at the last meeting in Alta, Norway, when the Indigenous peoples got together at the global level, calling for full and effective participation. This criteria has not been met, and Mr. John Ash, the President, General Assembly President, is pushing forward in a procedure that is excluding and diminishing and also, we would say, violating the rights of Indigenous peoples in terms of the UN Declaration itself, which the UN should be upholding. So it's a very turbulent period that is creating a lot of conflict around the world. The North American position is very clear from the Indigenous Peoples Caucus of North America. The call is for cancellation, and there's presently communications going out around the world to the different caucus of Indigenous peoples and government states to have that position be known and supported.
Tupac, why don't you take the listeners now? We talked about a couple things, and let's start with the North American Indigenous Peoples Caucus. What is that?
Well, you see, at the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, for operational purposes and for effective intervention, the Indigenous peoples of the world, prior to coming to the forum, organize themselves. We organize ourselves within different caucus, different settings of consultation, advice, and basically strategic positioning, you know. And in terms of this continent, the Abya-Yala continent, also known as the Americas, there's two caucuses that are functioning. And just for reminder as well, the concept and the procedure of caucus is an indigenous concept. It comes from a denomination, a term in the Algonquin languages, and it refers to a political mechanism of exchange of views and perspectives and strategy building that has basically consensus as its framework. You know? So the caucus functions as an instrument of consensus. You know? So in order to arrive at the permanent forum, the North American caucus gathers prior to the permanent forum session and discusses positions to be brought forward, the priority and the agenda that's going to be addressed. And these issues are discussed, analyzed, and then positions are articulated and defined to be taken to the UN. So the North American Caucus, the North American Indigenous Peoples Caucus, is that instrument for intervention, effective intervention, with prior consultation under the principle of consensus, and that's how it functions within the UN system. On the other side, it also functions as a external to the UN system as a mechanism for communication and coordination with the other caucuses of indigenous peoples in the world, including the overarching caucus that is in formulation for the entire hemisphere, the Abya-Yala caucus, which includes North America and also Latin American and Caribbean caucus, which is the other caucus that is operational.
Now, Tupac, when after the caucuses, they meet different times, and there's how many caucuses as a whole are they under the umbrella, if you will, of the permanent forum?
Well, they're not. They really wouldn't say they're under the umbrella, because the clarification there is that as indigenous peoples, and now with the declaration, peoples equal to all of the peoples, the understanding that we have is that we participate with the United Nations system is that we participate exactly like that, with it, but not under it. But the simple fact that our nationhood, our nations, precede, and would outlast, in our understanding, outlast that system that is now codified in the United Nations, just like we outlasted the League of Nations, which was the prior international body that was in place in the shape of international legal systems, you know, the League of Nations, and now we have the United Nations. But we as indigenous nations, we precede both, and we expect to outlast even this one. So we participate. There's, I believe, seven regions throughout the world: Arctic, Africa, Asia, Pacific. Excuse me, the Oceania, and there's also two global caucuses, which is the youth and the women. So that's the basic breakdown. I believe there's seven, and then two, which makes nine. The two being the global caucus of women and global caucus of.
So these caucuses represent a very much of a worldview.
Right. They represent specific geopolitical regions of the planet from indigenous peoples' nationhood participation, again, with the United States, United Nations system, but not under it. And we can say that very definitively because as the UN system itself has ascribed with the declaration in 2007, for the first time since 2007, now we exist in relationship to the UN as peoples equal to all other peoples, which means that our nationhood and also our international systems of national confederations would be also equal. And so we have our own confederations of national confederacies, international confederacies that are our own and are on an equal basis as well with the UN system. We don't have that condition at the planetary level yet, but yet that's just simple reality of who we are, who we've always been.
It's always been a process, Tupac, as far as indigenous peoples and their nations getting through the UN structure.
The aspiration has been for it to be a process, but this report that we're giving now, this isn't a process, this is a regress. This is an attempt by the UN system to basically domesticate these rights that we've been speaking of in terms of international law and the affirmation in international law by the UN Declaration. This is a regress, an attempt to ratchet back down the status that we now have won after so many decades, and we can even say centuries of not just process, but conflict and victory by achieving status as peoples. This so-called conference, this falsely called conference, we can say it never was a conference, is an attempt to domesticate international rights that we have in the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and bring them within the purview of domestic application, domestic implementation. And this is the scenario that we analyze is being promoted as an event to be titled a World Conference on Indigenous Peoples. Without Indigenous Peoples, how could that be a World Conference? It's a meeting of a high-level plenary of a General Assembly. And the mechanics of it, the mechanisms of it, this isn't a process at all. This is a regress. They're trying to take us back down to the domestic level, which is not why we went to the UN.
Tupac, maybe you could unpack this idea of domesticate a little. It's almost as if you're saying they're going to domesticate the movement that led to the passage of the Declaration.
Well, that's a trajectory we see unfolding. You know, you just connect the blots and that's what you see. You see the president, Mr. John Nash, refusing to acknowledge the simple reality, just start with the reality, that this isn't a conference, number one. Number two, there was a message that came out, I believe either yesterday or today, that he's proceeding in spite of the objections, in spite of the call for cancellation, in particular by the North American Caucus and solidarity statements coming out of the Arctic and other indigenous peoples. So if you take the case of the Marshall Trilogy, you know, where Chief Justice Marshall calls indigenous nations domestic dependent sovereignties. This scenario that's been played out here is the same story writ large. Now, this UN system is trying to call us internationally domestic dependent sovereignties. They're trying to screw us back into the pigeonhole of what it is that our nationhood depends on legitimization and legal status within the constitutions of each one of these states or national frameworks, such as the case of Canada, which is a subsidiary under the Crown of England. Canada is still under the Crown of England. And here's the coincidence. Coincidentally, Mr. John Ash, who's a representative to the UN from the country of Barbados, Antigua, that country, Barbados, Antigua, is also one of the Commonwealth nations of the Queen of England in this continent. So we're talking to a gentleman who's a president of the General Assembly, who is a subject of the Queen of England, talking to us on our own continent about our rights in this territory, in this continent. There's some major corrections that got to be made.
So, Tupac, if I were to say, all right, understood the process, understood domesticate, meaning underneath the thumb of the U.S. government, for instance, what is this leader from Barbados and Antigua specifically want to change in the rules that furthers that domestication of indigenous peoples?
It's the process that Mr. John Ash, as president of the General Assembly, who will be leading this high-level plenary, and he's placed himself as the decider, the singular position. There is no consultation. The way it's been done is by the mechanisms that are being implemented under the operations of the procedures to realize this high-level plenary. And under the mechanisms that Mr. John Ash is implementing, there is no real consultation with indigenous peoples themselves. There is no allowance for consent, and the call for cancellation has been disregarded completely, apparently, from the latest message that we've heard. So we're talking about a revolt within the UN participatory mechanisms where the indigenous peoples will not ascribe to this violation of our rights of full and equal participation in the international systems of Mother Earth, including the UN systems. And the fact that the declaration is being violated by these procedures, which were set up, again, by the UN and by the UN mechanism without full and effective equal participation, it's another realization that in our analysis brings us to the conclusion that when the UN system began to at least articulate, if not implement, the right of free, prior, and informed consent of indigenous peoples for economic development projects on indigenous territories, this became a major problem there for the transnational corporations. And in a way, we see that this attempt by the UN to subvert the full and effective participation is also a way to get around the problem that they have of requirements of full and effective participation in terms of free, prior, and informed consent of indigenous peoples on economic development projects. And so here's another coincidence. Mr. John Ash, who's the president of the General Assembly, leading this charge at the present moment, is also an official of the International Monetary Fund. So there's all kinds of loops in this story, but none of them connect to the right of self-determination of indigenous peoples. Again, it looks like an attempt at the international level to re-domesticate our international rights, self-determination, free, prior, and informed consent, full and effective participation, and allow those rights to be strictly interpreted within the framework of the national laws of each country, which is not why we went to the UN in the first place.
Tupac, Article 18, I want to read it for people that don't have it in front of them or don't know what it is. Indigenous peoples have the right to participate in decision-making in matters which would affect their rights through representatives chosen by themselves in accordance with their own procedures, as well as to maintain and develop their own indigenous decision-making institutions. Now, number one, Tupac, even within this, you have the UN, passed the Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Here you have other articles, and you talked about the other articles regarding the consensus and decision making. But here, this Article 18 has the language that says that anything that is decision making, Indigenous peoples have the right, and according to their own procedures, to participate. They are not doing that. Is that correct?
There's no way. There is no way. For example, when the idea of having a world conference on indigenous peoples was brought forward, it was originally brought forward by the country of Bolivia. And even at that point, the idea was an interesting idea, but our full and effective participation discussing the pros and cons and the timing of such an event, you know, without deciding whether it was whether it should or should not happen, there's a question of when it should happen. That participation was lacking as well. We were never brought into the loop at the very beginning. And ever since then, like we've said before, it was always under, as this scenario plays out, it's always been described as a high-level plenary meeting of the General Assembly, meaning only the government states. Only the government states are going to have a voice and have the determining factor in the final outcomes document. And this final outcome document, you know, it could be literally a threat to the rights that are already articulated and described in the Declaration. It comes in at a lower level of recognition and implementation of the rights of indigenous peoples, which is the direction it's heading, because we are not being given full and effective participation in the processes leading up to this high-level plenary. Our requests for counsel have fallen on deaf ears, apparently. And Mr. John Nash, the current president, is moving forward in a manner to where he's delegating participatory roles in this process strictly as if he was the emperor of the entire international system and could decide singularly who's going to be the voice of indigenous peoples, which is contrary to what we just read, no? And full and effective participation is totally missing. For that reason, cancellation has been called for by the North American Indigenous Peoples Caucus to cancel this process, to cancel this atrocity, which pretends to be a process, which in reality is a regress. We're going backwards with this.
Tupac, that's a good explanation, I feel. And given that, Tupac, Native people, indigenous people that might not participate directly or hear about the North American Indigenous Peoples Caucus or the Permanent Forum, United Nations, what's so important about this from your point of view? Here you are, you've been participating many decades. You are the ambassador, you're from the Tonatiara, kind of like an embassy of indigenous peoples. What's so important about we need to pay attention?
We're at a critical point. Again, we're at a critical point because we always, you know, contextualize everything within the overarching crisis of climate. You know? And the indigenous peoples of Mother Earth, you know, it's pretty well established, it's recognized that we're the best hope for achieving homeostasis of human society planetarily with the natural world. And so, therefore, the fight that we have for our rights as indigenous nations and our nationhood outside of the constraints of the UN system, the importance of it is that it's not only for our own sake and our own self-survival, self-determination and sustainability, because it's the hope for all humanity as to how we may regenerate our relationship with the natural world as nations of Mother Earth, no? And the UN system is basically an instrument that we've had to contend with, and we've battled through to get to the point where we achieved this recognition in 2007 that would allow us to move forward together in coexistence with the government states of the UN system and nations of indigenous peoples towards this future of sustainability for human society. But now with this latest move, it seems to be an operational plan at the planetary level, at the global level of the UN system, to ratchet the progress that we've made ratcheted back down and take us back again into an international dependent domestic frame that would allow the declaration that we've been speaking of for so long, allow it to put it back in the hands of the national governments of each country as to how, with the best practices, so-called, they could address the rights that you just read in the declaration, for example, the right of self-determination included. So it's a critical moment in the movement of indigenous peoples, not only in North America, but across the world. And for that same reason, we need to fight with coherence and the original purpose of why we were sent to engage with this international system of the UN and bring our issues forward in the manner that we were originally instructed to do it, as nations of Mother Earth, and not as ethnic groups of the states, which is the game that they're trying to play on us, as if they could just play with us like mice in a mouse trap while they eventually plan our final demise and our final annihilation.
Tupac, September 13th of this year will be the seventh year since the passage of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. I wonder if, in the context of all you've said, if you give us a feel for how you look at, and others working at your level, look at the progress made over those 7 years in engaging the global community and their organization, the United Nations.
Well, you know, we have to also report as well, you know, that at this meeting that took place in Kamloops, you know, among the, in the nation, the territories of the Tsleil-Waututh peoples, the Tsleil-Waututh nations, there was very definite signals given at this meeting to where, you know, they call the line, the northern relatives call the line between U.S. and Canada as a medicine line, right? But it was very definite that none of the nations there in our caucus, the North American Indigenous Peoples Caucus, used that line as a reference for their identity as a nation. As a matter of fact, it was considered pretty evident that the line was really irrelevant in terms of our nation, nationhood and territorial rights. It was a violation of those same rights and national identities. Well, that same reality very clearly at this meeting in Kamloops was identified in terms of the violation that the other border in this northern part of the hemisphere also ascribes, the border between U.S. and Mexico. There was a very clear call by the elders and by the spiritual guides to move forward together in terms of Turtle Island, the Great Turtle Island, as the phrase was used, in relationship to the other part of the continent in the south. So even though we've had these conflicts, contradictions, and battles, and they're ongoing, they don't expect them to end. At the same time, these meetings and gatherings over the past 7 years and going back over the past 30 years since Wounded Knee 73, when we first went to the UN, they've been opportunities for us as well to communicate with each other on our own terms and according to our own rhythms, cultural understandings, and trajectories of self-determination, and weave those together independently of the work that we do within the halls of the UN system. And in reality, this has probably been the major part of the work, although this work hardly ever gets reported, no? Except on programs such as this one, because it's not the work that it's officialized within the UN system, but it's going on all the time just the same. And the proof of this, of course, is that last year in November, as we conducted the Fifth Continental Summit, one of the communiques from that summit was sent to the Vatican related to the doctrine of discovery, a Christian discovery in the papal bulls. Well, we're here to report today, Corey, that that agenda item is going to be on the agenda once again coming May at the level of the United Nations Permanent Forum. And at that point, we expect to receive the response from the Vatican related to this issue that's been simmering for over 500 years now. So we go to the UN not to work under them, like we said originally. We have to contend with that system. We have to work with it. We're mandated to work with it with a spirit of mutual self-respect, but not as subsidiaries, not as subjects, not as elements to be dominated, but as nations of Mother Earth contending with another system that has established itself to dominate international geopolitical relationships. But again, at the cost of what? At the cost of our humanity, at the cost of our relationship with Mother Earth, and without a vision about what would be a sustainable future for all beings on this planet. And that's the role that we have as indigenous nations to bring forward that healing process. And it's very difficult, it's very challenging. And of course, the most difficult and challenging part of it is when we find our own folks on the other side of the aisle.
is with Tona Tierra in Phoenix, Arizona. He is a regular contributor to American Indian Airwaves Coyote Radio. Up next, Urban Indigenous and a look at Farm Lab. We'll hear from Cindy Alvitri of the Tiot Society and Olivia Chumacero from Farm Lab. You're in tune with American Indian Airwaves Coyote Radio.
Extermination. Oh, 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 oh.
I'm Marcus Lopez.
This is Cindy Alvitre.
I'm Olivia Chumacero.
I'm Fabiana Hirsch.
And I'm Corey Dubin. You're in tune with American Indian Airways Coyote Radio. We turn our attention to our ongoing series, Indigenous Urban, and we take this opportunity to bring two new members to the American Indian Airways Coyote Radio production collective, and that's Cindy Alvitri from the Tiot Society and Olivia Chumacero, also from Los Angeles, who's been very active in what we're going to talk about today, and that's Farm Lab, a sustainable agricultural development project going on in Los Angeles, which fits right in with Marcus, our series, Indigenous Urban, and the look at what all this migration of indigenous into places like Los Angeles County, which now has the highest number of indigenous people of any county in the lower 48 in the United States, and the kind of things they are doing. And we thought that Farm Lab would be a good example of some of those things, so we're really pleased to welcome Cindy and Olivia, both to the production team as well as to this interview on this important project. Cindy, give us a little background. Give the listeners a feel for the history and what Farm Lab is.
Today we want to take our listeners on a bit of a journey and slow down and maybe even stop to consider what is the memory of the land of Los Angeles and how that has traveled and become significant and embraced by contemporary Angelenos and pre-contact descendants of Los Angeles. And this takes us to the village of Yangna and the relationship it has to the Farm Lab, which has now become the state Los Angeles State Historical Park, which is located right off of north of Chinatown, around off of Alameda. We can begin by talking about what existed in pre-contact times, and the principal village that was in Los Angeles was a village site that is known today as Yangna. It has been affiliated with the current name of Los Angeles, the original name of Los Angeles. Some people will say the village of Yah. So if you were from Yah, you would have been a Yahvit. Although there's also been other terms, because if we think about how the people, our descendants, lived, they were very related to the river that has become a point of controversy as she continues to be trapped in this concrete vault, really. And the Los Angeles River in the village of Yangna, those people had a relationship. So that village traveled continually for thousands of years along that river, and those people lived with the river, something that we just don't have a relationship for many, many different reasons. There has been that attempt and even efforts and passion that's been extended into this project that became known as the Farm Lab. When we talk about the village of Yangna, which was a principal village, and ultimately, after missionization, it becomes a refugee camp. It became a refugee camp in the sense that the villagers were attempting to keep some reminiscence of a traditional lifestyle as the Mission San Gabriel was growing and in abundance taking in slaves to their institution. But it became more and more difficult for them to do that. So in essence, they become a place for the people who cannot, do not exist anymore in a traditional lifestyle to come to Yangna.
What years are we talking about there if you want this journey? Well, what about giving us a timeline?
We can start in pre-contact times, which is time immemorial, and in 1769 is actually first contact with the people of that community. With soldiers of the Portola Expedition as they traveled west, they crossed the Rio Hondo River, the San Gabriel Rivers, going westward, and ultimately they come across the Los Angeles River, and that's where we get the naming of Los Angeles, as they name it after Our Lady of the Angels of Porciúncula, as they pass the village of Yangna. So from 1784 to about 1836 is where you have a height of the mission system. The mission system in San Gabriel is established in 1771. The records are pretty sparse, other than a few mentions, like you bump it up to 1803, and they do mention in the record that the population of Yangna, this is post-contact when rancherias and missions and settlers are now in what is considered to be the Pueblo, they begin to outnumber the village site. At 1803, the population is said to be about 200. By 1830, as the city of Los Angeles is really growing exponentially and Indians become outnumbered by settlers, what you have is Yangna as a spring work, a seasonal work camp, and you have Indians coming from Mission San Diego, from San Luis Rey, from all over the place, as everybody is responding to this this whole process of colonization. By 1836 is a very significant date, because that's when the public pressure forces the relocation of Yangna into a new district. The citizens of Los Angeles at that point are complaining. They're saying that the Indians are washing their clothes in the Zanja, in the rivers, in their waterway. They don't like the way they live. And mostly they are very afraid when they begin to gather. As they gather for ceremonies, they complain about this. So they're relocated. And that location, if you were to try to find a very distinct place, that would be right where the 101 freeway and Alameda is. It's pretty much a freeway on-ramp. So ultimate death of Yangna is in 1847, when the city of Los Angeles council votes to burn down the village. And it's in fall of 1847. The Pueblito, as they referred to it, was raised to end disorderly gatherings. A sum total of $24 was paid to compensate the Indians for their home. And I'm quoting this out of Bill McCauley's First Angelinos. Thereafter, all employers were required to provide shelter and care for their Indian laborers. Self-employed Indians were required to stay outside the city limits, while employed Indians were assigned to the public works or jailed. And you see a lot of episodes of the original people, the Gabrielino Tonga, attempting just to survive for their lives. It's a very long, tragic history that begins in pre-contact times, and as the genocide of the mission system is put into effect, and the people that stay outside of that, they have to survive in other ways. And the village of Yangna really represents that. It is a central, it is ground zero of indigenous action and activities that are happening in Los Angeles from the point of missionization until that village site is burned down in 1847. So it is most ironic and maybe serendipitous, I don't know, that when Lauren Vaughn proposed to clean up the area where the farm lab is located, the old cornfield, that the whole legacy of Yangna comes alive. Actually, what you do have here is you begin to have this overlapping in history. The mission system is beginning to disintegrate right around 1820, 1823, as the Pueblo begins to grow. And the Catholic system begins to create a foundation in downtown Los Angeles. By 1820, is when you have the first church that is there, and that's the Queen of Angels Church. And that controversy became active again with the recent disruption and the violation of the L.A., the City Plaza, the cemetery there at the church. Because the church is established in 1820, but there is a clear presence of the people being there. As far as institutional history, that is very sparse in any mentions about Gabrielino Tongva or the indigenous people of Los Angeles. Where were they burying? Where were they living? You know, where were the original cemeteries? They're not sanctified unless they were in the process of being destroyed or being confined and colonized as Catholic institutions. We know that 1820 is that marking point there. You also initiate this system of, I call it indentured servitude, it's slavery. The Indian people that did survive from this village system and they go into the communities, they really don't have many choices as far as how they will survive. So many of the men work in the ranches. I mean, this is where you have this emergence of prostitution and domestic workers and a lot of abusive kinds of labor categories there. This is where you start having these collectives. This refugeeism that I'm talking about involves not only the indigenous people, not only our ancestors, but also the Chinese community and the Mexican community and the Black community. So that action is also happening. So there's a lot happening as far as the displacement, the disenfranchisement, the sweeping of Indian LA. But very little is written. There is just mentions because I suspect to give it any credence, especially as the American government will take over very soon by 1848, to establish or to document that there was a survival of the people would mean that they would have to be part of the American system in a very wealthy, wealthy area, and that was not part of the American plan.
You might say, Cindy, that this whole history was, and a lot of people just don't really, it's hard to put your arms around this. We're talking about a whole changing of a social system from a natural economy to working and understanding the landscape and the skyscape, and where the Europeans came in, the introducing the a kind of a feudal sitio ecomendia system, and a forced labor and a slavery. The first slaves were California Indian people. The first slave, the mentality of slavery, and this whole system was a shifting of it, you know, with the Spanish and then the Mexican and then the Californian, which has had its onslaught on Native people in the whole state of California. And at the same time, and particularly within Los Angeles, it's kind of hard to put your hand around, because here you have people living close to the land, natural economy, and shifting to this imperialistic feudal system, which had all the social implications. And then finally, precursor to 1848 and then finally 1850s, the first legislation of California was definitely put into place that you're talking about, the slave initiative, indentured servitude, and all that go with it, the women's slavery and child slavery. They call it by a different term, but I want to be direct about this. This is the history of that downtown Los Angeles area, would you not say?
But I think it's more than the social implications. I think it is, and I know it's very much about the social natural implications. Well, we're changing from a natural economy, and that's what our conversation is really trying to get to the point today, because we can recant history, a tragic history in Los Angeles. We can give the few details. But what is really felt and what is very obvious, especially today, as we are all, as human beings, experience this global change, you know, the mood of Mother Earth and also the personality of Mother Earth via climate change that is impacting us. The relationship of Yangna was to the river. The relationship of the people was to the land. It's about the land and the relationship to the land. This story is very much about how that was severed, how that was attempted to be destroyed but was severely altered. And yet, there's a thread a very strong, strong thread, a DNA, a genetic memory that has continued with the people many generations and is felt by all the people who reside in that area to this day and who visit that area, because the legacy of Yangna continues. It's felt by the Chinese community as they've come to visit us at the farm lab, by the people of Mexican descent, so the African Americans, everybody in that northern Los Angeles sector. And that consciousness was coming forward, all the pain, the grief, the healing, so that we could move forward. And unfortunately, that seems to have been halted by the state of California, Parks and Recreation right now, as they're in the process of redesigning that which has already been established at the farm lab, the anabolic monument. That social natural relationship has to be regenerated. It has to be renewed, revivified.
I'm Marcus Lopez.
This is Cindy Alfitre.
I'm Olivia Chumacero.
I'm Fabiana Hirsch.
And I'm Corey Dubin. You're in tune with American Indian Airways Coyote Radio and our conversation regarding the Los Angeles First Nations Project Farm Lab. Sustainable agriculture in Los Angeles is the topic with Cindy Alvitri from the Tiot Society and Olivia Chumacero from Farm Lab.
And with that, Olivia, why don't you give us a little background on the what we term the Farm Lab. Take us by the hand, and we're on the journey of what's the history of the Farm Lab.
In 2005, artist Lauren Bond began the cleanup of the brownfield, which was called not a cornfield, by planting corn. And the seeds came from the Hopi Nation, and the entire process was done in ceremonial and respectful manner, honoring the indigenous people of the land and bringing life to the land so that if we as human beings could have a relationship to nurture and manage the land back to its healthy state, and bringing forth also with that was all the biodiversity that comes when you manage land and take care of it in a natural way without imposing or manicuring it. And along with that came the cultural work tied to not only the land, but the diversity of which is now Los Angeles. So,
Olivia, what do you mean by cultural work? Why don't you explain that to our listeners?
The representation of all the various people that make up the city of Los Angeles from different parts of the world, but coming from an indigenous perspective, so that you come to the land, you honor the land, you take care of it, you manage it, you don't impose your will, and the manner in which we now do, you know, massive agriculture.
And why don't you, Olivia, why don't you explain to our listeners specifically what are people, how's that expressed, what you just said?
That is expressed by doing ceremonies by all the various indigenous groups that came to the land, by having a relationship where earth, water, air, and sun are honored and respected. And all these ceremonies are done by the people that come to the land first before they ever engage in the management and the taking care of the land.
Cindy, tell us a little bit about what this means to you in terms of where the project's located, this whole history you've mapped out, and here we are in 2014. Tie it together. You've talked about some of the threads that continue to tie it together. I think the listeners would be really interested in that, if you expand on that a bit.
Well, you know, there's something called Invisible LA, Invisible Los Angeles, and that is the thousands of years of history of the land and the connect of the people to the land that people have no idea about. We became involved, and it's not all the tribal communities. It's a small handful of people who came to the land and at the invitation of Lauren Bond and Olivia, and we began to work as a community. One of the unique things that happened as part of this, it was unanticipated and really speaks to what survives with people who have experienced genocide and the impacts of significant colonization. And that was the death ceremonies or the ancestor ceremonies, which seemed to be the last to be given up. When Lauren planted, and it wasn't just Lauren, but the community planted these multiple acres of Hopi corn, it was a wonder in itself. I mean, just for children, adult people to be able to walk in the magnificence of these cornfields that you could get lost in. There was a maze that was carved out. There was an area there that was carved out for privacy, for aesthetics, for different reasons. And we did ceremony there. We did an ancestor ceremony in the fall, an all-night ceremony. First time on that brown field, now converted to a cleaned-up cornfield. And it was like traveling back in time. I mean, it was one of those moments when you felt the connect to the water. You could hear the water. You knew that that water from the LA River was underneath you. You knew she was confined in an esophagus or the coffin. And you were able to really feel that for the first time. It was a very emotional time for those of us that participated in the ceremony. But the irony was to come out of ceremony, out of those lodges, stand up in the middle of the night, and you have a silhouette of corn that you're surrounded by, gigantic 6 to 10 foot corn, and above that is a silhouette of the downtown Los Angeles. It was very sobering, visual, but spiritually very, very a reality check. But it gave us great strength, too. And it was at that point that many of us made a commitment to work with the farm lab, and to see what would happen to the land also once it's been cleaned up. Is there a genetic memory in the land? What plants would come back? Did plants come back? And to be able to slow down and to stop enough time in our lives to be able to observe those changes in the land. So it's been a magnificent past 8-9 years now, and as part of the collective of the Native community. And incidentally, I don't think Olivia mentioned this, but over the years, there's been at least 53 different tribal groups that have come to do ceremony and to join in being part of that land at all levels. It's significant. It is absolutely a center, the place of the gathering, the legacy of Yangna as a refugee camp, in the light of tragedy and trauma and ongoing significant changes on our planet. It is the refugee camp and continues to be the refugee camp.
And we're speaking with Olivia Comochero and Sydney Avitri as far as this topic is farm lab, a 2-acre area north of Chinatown. Now, Olivia, what is happening now? What is the state park is doing? Is threatening the land? Is threatening the farm lab? What's going on?
The state park has in place different phases of design for the park. So now it is going into the second phase of design. Initially, we had gotten an agreement to take care of the land for a specific period of time. What we did not know was that they were going to actually destroy all the work that we have put into the land. And with the new design, it comes with a 30,000 people venue for an amphitheater, and that is not part of the mission statement for the state parks. But the biggest blow here is that it has taken us 8 years, 9 years to clean up the land, to nurture it back to health, and all the biodiversity, the flora, the fauna, is now going to be taken out completely, so to accommodate the new design of the park. And what we're saying is it's a 34-acre parcel. We're speaking specifically to a 2-acre parcel of land that we have nourished and taken care of, where all the native flora lives right now. And we're asking if they could design around it so that we can continue taking care of the land and having it be a place where the indigenous people, the community at large, can come and do their ceremonies. And they're not having any of that.
Cindy, finally, give us a closing statement, if you will, about the values and what's most important about FarmLab and what you all are trying to accomplish today based on that long history you described.
Yeah, it's a very long history. It's exhausting, isn't it? It's exhausting to us, especially when, you know, as the Native community from Los Angeles, and that includes many people, those that have been active and those that have sat in the sidelines and those that have been advocates and supportive as the best they can. But, you know, this is another example of one of those situations where the tribal community is seduced into something by, and I won't say that happened by Lauren Vaughn or by Olivia, by the Farm Lab, but by the state park, where they seem to be well-meaning, well-intentioned, and suddenly this piece of land, you invest your whole heart and soul into this, and it's taken away from you. And the bottom line with this, with the Farm Lab and the land there, is that there's cottonwood trees, there's sycamores, there's white sage, there's deer grass, there's ceanothus, there's medicine plants, there's food. We teach about how to eat, how to be one with the, be with the land and to know the land. And it's all been taken away. It's as if everything that we said, we did, we modeled, we served action, all the trust, as if it meant nothing. Every one of those plants to us is alive. That land is alive again. And now it's being taken away. The whole, even if it's the redesign process, what does that mean, redesign? How do you redesign a whole section of a beautiful piece of land that's connected to the original people and the original intention by the creator of this planet to be lived in one way? How do you sever that from the people? It happens over and over. It's the sweeping of downtown Los Angeles once again.
The moment of silence is over.